Thank you. Thank you, Greg, for that introduction. And thank you to the Perimeter Institute for the chance to come here and speak to such a friendly looking, I can just about see you, audience. And thank you all for giving up your evening to come and listen to me. I have to confess I've been a little nervous about this talk, partly because I'm speaking to an audience used to a foreign language. Bang was translated into American. They actually employed somebody to do that. But I know you won't have any problems understanding my British tones. And partly because the word theoretical appears in the name of my prestigious host institution this evening. And I suspect I'm about as far from a theorist as it is possible to get while remaining a physicist. And certainly Galaxy Zoo is an attempt to deal with a problem caused not by pesky theorists and their thinking and their blackboards, but instead by a problem that's common, I think, across a lot of science, which is that something very strange is happening to us. It's something strange caused by an explosion in technology, in computing power, in the availability of cheap cameras, in bandwidth. Because in many areas of science, I think for the first time in a long while, we almost have too much data. And Galaxy Zoo is an example of that. As you've heard from Greg, we had the problem of what to do with a million galaxies. I'm sure it's an everyday problem that many of you have faced. But it's a serious problem. You know, if you have 100, then you can happily spend a career studying those 100 galaxies in great detail. But what do you do when you have a million? And I think that a lot of the science that happens in astronomy, in ecology, in climate science, over the next decade will be driven by how creatively we can solve that problem. And I'll argue later that in order to constrain, in order to really test our understanding of the universe, we need to get a better handle on using this data. So the plan is that I will talk a bit about how Galaxy Zoo came to be, give you some idea of where it sits and the problems it's addressing. I want to give you a flavor of the results that have been produced by ordinary people like yourself. Sorry, that sounds insulting, doesn't it? By the extraordinary people that come to lectures like this. That's better. I was going to make a note that I won't get that wrong next time. And hopefully inspire you to come and take part in our project, which is open to everyone. Before I do that, though, I want to do a couple of adverts at the start. I want to advertise a couple of new projects we have. Because inspired by Galaxy Zoo, we think that this idea of involving the public in data analysis is something that will be useful everywhere. So if you listen to the next hour and decide you never want to see a galaxy again, then can I recommend to you a site called Solar Stormwatch, built by our collaborators at the Royal Observatory in Greenwich, www.solarstormwatch.com. And this is a site which invites you to help us detect large amounts of material heading for the Earth. This is an image. The sun is just off to the right of this image. I think I can wander around. Yep. So the sun's over here. This is Venus over here. The Earth's about here on this image. And what you can see is what my colleague Chris Davis calls a billion tons of matter moving at a million miles an hour out across the solar system. It's what we call a coronal mass ejection. And if this hits the Earth, it causes problems for astronauts, causes problems for satellites, occasionally for power grids down here on the ground. And also it can produce spectacular displays of the Northern Lights. So we'd like to understand these things better, and we'd like to be able to predict them better. But we need your help to come and have a look at the data. If you go to the site, you see videos. You see material flowing from the right to the left. I love this one. This is the poor little thing getting in the way there is Comet Lulin. You can see the comet has its tail disconnected by the passage of the CME. So we can torture the comet over and over again. But you'll remember that, and you'll go home and hopefully use solarstormwatch.com. And I couldn't resist giving you, you've been such a friendly audience, you've laughed at least two of my jokes already, a preview of our next project. So in May, we launched a project called Moon Zoo. There's a spacecraft going around the moon now called Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. It's a NASA spacecraft. I touched it, and yet it still works. It's imaging the lunar surface with a resolution of about 30 centimeters. So in some of the images, you can see the Apollo spacecraft. You can even see the tracks left by the astronauts. But what we need to do is study the moon in that detail. And even if all the planetary scientists in the world spent all of their time looking at the data, we couldn't possibly go through it. So to find the interesting things, we're going to need people's help. If you want a sneak preview, you can go to moon.zooniverse.org. We've got a trial site up. We'd love to have your feedback about what works and what doesn't. And then in a few weeks' time, we've got 70,000 images for people to cut their teeth on. So that's the sun and the moon, but let's get back to sensible things like galaxies. And actually, it's appropriate that I started by talking about the interface between observations and theory, because the problem of having too many galaxies was caused by this thing behind me. This is a robotic telescope. This is the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. It sits on a mountaintop in New Mexico, and it's what happens when particle physicists build telescopes. It was built by a coalition led by Fermilab, University of Chicago, Johns Hopkins, and a few others. But it's essentially designed as an experiment, because looking at the universe on a large scale, we have plenty to interest astronomers like myself, but we also have a supreme test of our most extreme physics. And so Sloan was designed as an experiment. If we could detect the positions of about a million galaxies, and we can compare those positions to the early universe, you could do a very sensitive test to how the universe has expanded in the 13.7 billion years since the Big Bang. And so that's what it was designed to do. And it has a camera sitting on the back of it. And for about 8 years, it scanned the sky night after clear night. They get about 320 clear nights a year, so about the same as you do up here. I'd be reading the tourist board literature, you see. Anyway, 320 clear nights a year. It takes images in five colors, and then a computer decides if it's seen galaxies. When it has, and it almost always does, they go back and they measure the distances to those galaxies. And so what we end up with is a three-dimensional map of a slice of our local universe. And so I want to start by showing you our best view of our neighborhood. So we're going to start on the Milky Way, and we're going to zoom outwards through space at a rate that would put even Star Trek to shame. So this is data from a few years ago. So we've got 500,000 galaxies here. We now have a full million in the survey, which is now complete. We're going to start on the Milky Way, and we're moving outwards. And it looks a bit Hollywood and a bit like the start of a sci-fi thing, but this is real data. Each of these is the actual image of the actual galaxy in its correct place in space. And as we zoom outwards, something really quite striking is seen. You might expect the galaxies, we expected the galaxies to be scattered randomly across the sky on large enough scales, but they're not. There's structure out here. Ignore this big stripe down the middle. You'll see that's just an artifact. But this is real, for example. This is a structure called the Sloan Great Wall. This is 1.3 billion light years long, very long, in other words, made up of hundreds of thousands of galaxies. And there are big clusters of galaxies. And there are places where there are almost no galaxies at all. And we call them voids. And if you're in a poetic frame of mind, people call this the cosmic web. You get a space has a honeycombed structure. And as we rotate, you get a real sense of this filamentary structure. And really, the challenge for astronomers like myself, this ends up in the office of the people who made the video. This zooms out to the observable universe. So you can see that we've only mapped a tiny fraction of the observable universe. A million galaxies isn't much, but it's enough to give us a real sense. It's enough to give us a statistical sample. It's better than any opinion poll. You know, you don't ask everyone in the country how they're going to vote. You do that on election day, but if you want to predict it, you ask a few thousand. The odds are much better here. A million galaxies out of the 100 billion or so in the observable universe. So the odds aren't pretty good. And then, yes, you can see that the observable universe actually sits in a computer lab at the University of Chicago. If you learn only one thing tonight, it's that the universe is in the University of Chicago. Anyway, if you had to sum up in one sentence the challenge for astrophysics, right now. It's explaining how that cosmic web came to be. Can we tell a coherent story about how we ended up with this lumpy universe, this universe with filaments and voids? And you'll be surprised, I'm sure, to know that the answer is yes, we can. In fact, we could tell a surprisingly good story. The basic bits of it, I think, will be familiar to most of you, but we should go over them anyway, because the story, of course, starts with a Big Bang, with the universe in a hot, dense state 13.7 billion years ago. Remarkably, by the way, we know that number more accurately than we know the age of the Earth. So despite the fact that we could go out, we could do experiments, we could pick up rocks, we could take them into laboratories, we could study our own planet in a myriad different ways, we actually know the age of the universe more accurately than we know the age of our own planet. I like to say that because it makes us sound good compared to geologists. But actually, there's another fundamental truth there too, which is that the early universe is a very simple place. This is why it's loved by theoretical physicists, because you don't have to worry. You know, you could do calculations on a single blackboard or the back of an envelope. You don't have to worry about messy chemistry or what's dismissively known as gastrophysics, you know, stars and stuff that get in the way and make things complicated. You can make clean predictions. Of course, that's only true if we believe that the universe is expanding and was in a hot, dense state 13.7 billion years ago, but the evidence is pretty good. To give you all of it would take a few lectures, but it's worth looking at the original evidence, I think. This is, of course, the work by Hubble, who measured the distance to not a million galaxies, but about 20. He already knew from work by a colleague called Vesto Schleifer, who worked at Flagstaff in Arizona, that most galaxies were receding from us. You can see that when you split their light up and measure their spectrum. But what Hubble did was measure the distance, using the largest telescopes in the world, he measured the distance to each of these galaxies. And this is his original plot. I've redone it with modern units, but it's the original plot. Each dot is a galaxy. This is distance along here. So any galaxy over here is further away than a galaxy over here. The units are millions of parsecs, but millions of light years, give or take a factor of three. As will become obvious, a factor of three doesn't matter to an astronomer. And this is velocity, so this is the speed with which they're receding. So you'll see there's a few nearby ones down here that are actually coming towards us. I think this one is Andromeda. We're actually going to collide with the Andromeda galaxy in a few billion years. And you should mark your calendars now, because it's going to be spectacular. But you can see that there's a general trend here. Galaxies tend to live in the top right or the bottom left of this diagram. In other words, the further away a galaxy is, the faster it's receding from us. The further away a galaxy is, the faster it's receding from us. We call this now Hubble's law, after its discoverer. Now, I've been showing this plot in talks for a while now, and there's always somebody, usually a scientist who isn't an astronomer, who comes up and is unimpressed by this level of accuracy. This, to an astronomer, this is a really, 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 really good fit. Okay. I know my audience, because the amount of laughter that gets tells me how scientifically literate the audience are and how many economists there are in the audience. But just to satisfy the economists, here's the modern version of the same plot. Not from Hubble, but from Hubble Space Telescope. That's why the Space Telescope's named after Hubble. This was its first main task. Now we've got hundreds of millions of light years, tens of thousands of kilometers per second, and you've got this really nice straight line. The further away a galaxy is, the faster it's receding from us. Now how does that get us to the fact that space is expanding? Well, the easiest way to see this, I think, is to use this picture. This is a drawing by the Dutch artist and mathematician M.C. Escher. And what I want you to do is imagine that you're not sitting in this comfortable lecture hall, but that you're all crammed, standing together on this block here, looking out at this incredibly boring universe composed of blocks and rods. I think even Escher thought it was boring. He called this painting Cubic Space Division, which is about as unromantic a title as you could get. But nonetheless, imagine we're all sitting on this block down here. And I want you to imagine that in this world, the rods that join the cubes together are expanding. And let's have them expand at some constant rate. In fact, let's have them expand at 10 miles an hour. The number doesn't matter. What would we see? Well, the first thing is that you'd see all the other cubes rushing away from each other. We'd appear to be at the center of the expansion because all the other cubes are rushing away from us. Mind you, the same is true. If I put you not down here, but up here, exactly the same thing is true. You'd still see all the cubes rushing away from you. So there's no real center to this expansion. Just as the fact that we see all the galaxies rushing away from us doesn't mean we're at the center of the universe, or that the Big Bang had a center. The other thing is, if you concentrate on individual blocks, you can get to something quite profound. We're here. This block will be receding in that direction at 10 miles an hour because of the expansion of this rod. This block in the top right will be heading in the same direction, but at 20 miles an hour, because this rod is expanding and this rod is expanding. The further away a block is from us, the more rods there are between us and it. The more rods there are, the faster the expansion. In other words, we have a kind of Hubble's law going on. And if you replace the cubes with galaxies and the rods with space, and you allow space itself to expand at some rate that we can measure, then the more space there is between us and a distant galaxy, the faster it will be receding. And so from Hubble's simple observation, you get the idea not really that the galaxies are moving away from us through space, but that space itself is expanding. And once you get that idea, you can run the picture backwards in your head. Space can contract as you look into the past, and you end up with this hot, dense, small universe back 13.7 billion years ago. And in fact, we can get a glimpse of what that universe looked like about 300,000 years after the beginning, 300,000 to 400,000. And we do this by looking up at the sky, and we see leftover radiation from that time. We see what's called the cosmic microwave background radiation. So this is, you see this wherever you look in the sky. In fact, if you still have analog televisions, then a few percent of the black and white fuzz that interferes with your television signal is actually from this radiation. It's sort of this profound observation of the early universe that gets in the way of watching whatever soap opera or reality show you want to see. That's probably why it's there. Anyway, the point is that this early universe isn't uniform. We see tiny fluctuations in it. It's mostly smooth. Unlike the clumpy universe of today, the difference between these red bits, which are in this map low density places, and the densest part of the universe, these dark bits, is only one part in 10,000. It's a pretty smooth universe, but nonetheless, there are tiny fluctuations. And it's the discovery of these, which was made way back in 1992 by the COBE satellite, that gives us the clue to how galaxies form today. So what we could do is we could use this observation of the early universe as the starting point for a simple computer model. That's what people do with some of the largest computers in the world. These are the results from something called the Millennium Simulation, which ran on an extremely large supercomputer in Germany. And its aim was to go from the simple universe of the microwave background to the universe we see today, basically using only gravity. So this is a snapshot from the simulation, fairly close to the start, 15 million years after the beginning. The color code here is density. So where there's a light patch, there's more stuff than average. Where there's a dark patch, there's less stuff than average. So this is a clump of matter. This is a region where there's less than the average stuff. And what happens is that gravity exaggerates these tiny differences. It's a simple way of putting this is that the rich get richer, the poor get poorer. So imagine, and why does this happen? Well, imagine you're a particle sitting here, a blob of gas, a tiny asteroid or something. And you have to decide whether to go this way or whether to go this way. Well, down here there's more stuff than there is pointing that way, so you're going to get pulled in this direction. And that means that this blob will gain your gravitational attraction, so you'll be able to pull in more material from the surroundings, and so you have this almost runaway effect. As we go from 15 million years to 1 billion years to 5 billion years to today, what starts as quite a smooth universe becomes quite a clumpy one. And it begins to look like the cosmic web that I showed you. We have areas where there are clumps of galaxies. We have large voids where there's almost nothing. It's easier to see, actually, if I run this as a movie. I've taken out the expansion of the universe so we can see what's going on. Otherwise, you need an expanding screen and an expanding lecture theatre. You can see we start with a smooth universe, and we end up pretty quickly with a beautiful cosmic web. And the next stage of the research would be to roll a dice or something, pick a random number, put yourself on one of these blobs, pretend you have a telescope like the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, see what you get, see what you would see, and compare that to the real one. Roll the dice again, move to a different blob, build up a picture of what an average survey would look like in this universe, and compare it to the real one. And the remarkable triumph of astronomy, of computer modeling and of thought, is that actually you can't distinguish the two. If you take your theoretical universe and our biggest map of the universe around us, we have a model that matches more or less whatever question you want to ask. You could say, okay, well, what's likely to be the biggest thing in my survey? And it turns out there's a 1 in 3 chance you get something like the Sloan Great Wall. Doesn't seem like bad odds. You can ask, how many Milky Way-sized blobs will I see? You get that answer right. How empty are the biggest voids? We get that answer right. And what will the largest galaxy clusters look like? We get that right. You can even compare, you could stop this movie at any point and begin to compare to the past. So with some of these earlier stages, maybe here, you could compare that to some of the Deep Hubble Space Telescope photos and do a comparison, and you get that right. So in some sense, we've succeeded in the goal that I set 10 minutes ago, in that I can explain with this computer model the large-scale structure of the universe. So we can either go home, or I can explain why we don't stop there. I'm not going to take a vote. The problem is that I've essentially lied to you, because the model that puts this, that creates this, is simple, but is deeply unsatisfactory. Because what it is, it's a model that has 95% of its energy in forms that we don't understand. So this is the budget for the universe that goes into the computer model that matches reality. Only 0.03% of the energy in the universe is in the form of ordinary matter. So if you didn't feel insignificant before, you certainly should do now. 0.3%, 10 times as much, is in the form of neutrinos. So I should have said the 0.03% is in everything other than hydrogen and helium, what astronomers call metals. 0.3% neutrinos. Only 0.5% of the universe is in the form of stars. And if you think about that, that's actually a big problem, because when we look at the sky, almost regardless of which wavelength you choose, most of the information you get is from stars, from things that create light. And if only 0.5% of the universe is emitting light, we need to be very sure, before we trust any of those results, that that 0.5% is representative. It's like, deciding that you're going to survey the population of Toronto by listening to who's loudest at 10 o'clock on a Friday night and paying attention to them. You may be missing a lot of the story. 4% of the universe is in hydrogen and helium, so that gives us almost 5% in stuff we understand. 25% of this universe is in the form of something called dark matter. This is stuff that holds galaxies together and galaxy clusters together. It has gravity, but it doesn't interact with light, and it's not made of ordinary matter. If you don't put dark matter in, then this exaggerating process doesn't work as well. You have less stuff, and so you end up with a smoother universe today than the one we actually see. So gravity must be more powerful. We must have more stuff there. With the caveat that if you can come up with a clever way to break gravity, then you can get rid of dark matter. But no one has yet quite done that satisfactorily. 70% of the energy in the universe is in the form of dark energy. This is an accelerating force. The expansion of the universe is speeding up. And as we don't even have a clue what that is, I'm going to come back to it at the end of the talk. So what do we do? How do we attack the fact that we have a model that fits the observations, but which gives us 95% of the universe in stuff we don't understand? Because science proceeds when you have a result that doesn't make any sense. Because that's meat for the theorists to get their teeth into. It's a trigger to be creative. I think it was Arthur C. Clarke, of all people, said that the most exciting words in science aren't eureka or I've got it, but actually something along the lines of, hang on, that doesn't make any sense at all, because then you know you've got something you can get a handle on. And so what we need to do is look for observations that tell us about the universe on the largest scales that don't agree. And I wonder if any of you have spotted the sleight of hand that I've pulled. Because when I showed you the beautiful images from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, they were actual images of galaxies. And when I showed you the simulations, what you saw were blobs. And when I said you compared the simulations to observations, I said things like, how many things the mass of the Milky Way are there? How empty is the emptiest voids? I didn't say anything about the galaxies themselves. And as you saw from the slideshow that preceded my lecture, galaxies come in a beautiful variety of forms. They're not just blobs. You get disk galaxies, elliptical galaxies, merging galaxies, warped galaxies. And each one of these has a story to tell. And the shape encodes the history of that galaxy's lifetime. Actually, thinking about it, it's a bit like people. But anyway, the fact that this is one way to form an elliptical galaxy is to merge two spirals together. So we can suggest that this elliptical is the product of a merger. And thus, by looking at where the ellipticals live, maybe we could deduce something about where galaxies merge. Maybe that tells us that this spiral hasn't undergone a merger. So it must have led an isolated, blameless life. There are strange things like ring galaxies. 2% of all mergers look something like this, but they only happen when you get a bullseye collision between a smaller galaxy and a bigger galaxy. So the challenge for the models should be not just, good start. You've told us where stuff the size of the Milky Way is. Now tell us where your model thinks that things that look like the Milky Way should be, and how many of them should there be, and where in the universe do they live, and when did they first appear? It's a much more stringent challenge, and the hope is that if we can really test our model with these details, we might begin to unpick the behavior of the dark matter, and that might give us a clue as to what on earth it is. Sounds simple enough, but this is where we hit this problem of having too many galaxies. If you look at the development of the field, in the 50s, when people first did the first big surveys of the sky using big photographic plates, maybe you had a few hundred images of galaxies that were detailed enough to show this kind of detail. So it's easy. If you have 100, that's a professor. So people would publish atlases of galaxies in which, you know, Professor de Vaucouleurs or so on would go through and he'd take a page per galaxy and he would classify it as this might be a SC3B non-barred regular grand design spiral. And each of these numbers would mean something. And then, you know, on the next page you'd have, this is an SC3 barred whatever it is. And you could really get to know these galaxies personally. The equivalent of a reality TV show instead of the survey that we did earlier. You know, you're really paying attention to a few individuals. In the 80s, a new generation of sky survey came along, using still film, interestingly, but a treated advanced film, produced maybe thousands of galaxies. No professor in the world has time for that, so you have a student whose thesis is based on classifying 1,000 galaxies. And then they write up their thesis, and no one else has to do it, and we're fine, and we can move on. The sociology of this is interesting as well, you see. And so what do we do in the first decade of the 21st century when we're faced with 1 million galaxies? Computer models, by the way, don't do a very good job of this. They get 70% or so right, but you never know which 30% they've got wrong. So a computer's not as good as a human. We've got 1 million galaxies. Clearly, we set the problem for a student. The student's name in Oxford's case was called Kevin. Kevin Savinsky. He's now a postdoc at Yale, having escaped Oxford as quickly as possible. And Kevin looked at 50,000 galaxies. And the first result of Kevin's thesis was that a student will look at 50,000 galaxies before he tells you where you can stick the other 950,000. The second result of Kevin's thesis, and this is around the time that I joined Oxford, was that we really need, it was obvious from the results that he'd got, that we really needed to look through the rest. And it was clear that Kevin wasn't doing it. And so we needed to recruit a wider workforce. And we thought we'd start by simplifying the problem. Let's ask the simplest possible question. This is a traditional classification of galaxies. It's actually Hubble again, our old friend. It's called the tuning fork diagram. And galaxies run from elliptical all the way to spiral. And he thought this was an evolutionary sequence. He thought galaxies started off big and round and would collapse under their own gravity and then form arms which would then unwind. Doesn't quite work like that, but the classifications are pretty good. And actually, the fundamental divisions, for those in the lecture theatre, are displayed on either wall. I don't know if this is deliberate because I was here, but you have spiral galaxies on one hand, and you have elliptical galaxies on the other. We'll throw out the irregulars. Ellipticals tend to be older. They tend to be boring. They tend to not have star formation. They tend to be devoid of gas. They tend to be larger, whereas spirals are young, dynamic places with where stars are still forming. And so that's the task we set our original Galaxy Zoo users. You turned up on a website. You passed a test. The test was pitched just about right. We know at least one six-year-old passed it, and I know at least one professor of physics failed it. So I think we got it about right. And then you got a random galaxy from the million or so of Sloan. And one of the remarkable things is that when we started, most of these had never been seen by humans. Sloan had imaged them, decided it was a galaxy, dictated the follow-up, processed the image, measured some stuff about the galaxy without humans ever becoming involved. So you really could be the first person to see this galaxy. And six buttons. Is it an elliptical or a spiral? If it's a spiral, tell us which way the arms are going. There's a button for a star that snuck past the computer, and a button for beautiful merging galaxies. And that was it. You click a button, you get another galaxy. You click a button, you get another galaxy. It's like eating crisps. It turns out there are just enough beautiful ones that you just keep going because they might just get a beautiful spiral. The original idea, as Greg alluded to, was that I'd give a talk like this in my copious spare time. You would all go and classify 10 galaxies each. Next month I'd do the same. And we thought we could get the million galaxies classified in 3 to 5 years. Didn't work out like that. This is the summer of 2007. July, 14th of July, in fact. We launched the site, and it got picked up by the BBC. And the BBC News website, in particular, ran a feature on the story. And this website is one of those where you can email interesting stories to your friends just by clicking a button. And they keep a league table of which stories are being emailed most often. So somewhere around 10 o'clock on the 14th of July, this is the league table. We were second, Scientists Seek Galaxy Hunt Help. We were ahead of Garlic May Cut Cow Flatulence. Which, actually, I feel guilty about this because this is a suggested solution to global warming. So it's more important than, but you know, you can't win it all, and we're behind Man Flies to Wedding a year early. Later in the day, we were still in the charts, but what can you do about Huge Dog is Reluctant Media Star? A story which I'm sure many of you remember. The effect was unbelievable. This was the result of the first few days. This is hours since launch. The first thing to point out on this graph is, and this is number of classifications, you'll notice there's a gap here. There's a gap about 4 hours in. This is the point at which the server, the computer that supplied the images, caught fire. The server sits in a basement in Baltimore at Johns Hopkins, and it had been happily supplying images to astronomers for two years prior to this. It was, in fact, the core computer that supplied the Sloan results to any astronomer that wanted it. The administrator, who is a very tolerant man, Jan Vandenberg, was woken up in the middle of the night, his time, by an automated system telling him his server had caught fire. Dashed into to work to discover that his boss had allowed these people called Galaxy Zoo to link to it. Unbelievably, instead of coming to hunt me down with a knife, he built us a new web server, and we were back online 8 hours after the start. So Jan saved the project because it just took off. So to give you some scale, the largest published sample of galaxies, the Japanese team, three of them looked at 3,000 each. So that's there. The unit of galaxy classification, in Kevin's honor, is the Kevin month. So that's 50,000 galaxies. So you can see that we were doing two days after launch, we were doing a Kevin month of galaxies per hour. 50,000 classifications. And the pace calmed down a bit. But where are we now? Almost 3 years later, across a couple of incarnations of the project, we've had almost 200 million classifications from 270,000 people. Better than that, the results are really good. Because it turns out, in fact, they're better than just having Kevin do them all, to his relief and mine. Because if you think about it, if all of us looked at the same image and made an independent classification, we can say something with huge confidence about what that image is. If Kevin had really looked at all million galaxies and made some of the discoveries that we made, people would have been perfectly at liberty to just say that Kevin doesn't know how to classify galaxies. But if 100 people have looked at the same galaxy and they all agree, we can say with a measurable degree of confidence that that really is a spiral or an elliptical or whatever. And so that's what we've got. Instead of just having a million galaxies, we've now got ellipticals, we've got clockwise spirals, we've got anti-clockwise spirals, we've got edge-on spirals, these needle-shaped things, we've got alien spaceships, and we've got mergers. These are actually satellites, camera faults, and so on, I promise. But then I would say that, wouldn't I? So just to bring you up to date, Zoo 1 was July 2007. February 2009, we launched Zoo 2, which is a closer look at 250,000 galaxies. Tell us not just whether it's a spiral or elliptical, but tell us how many spiral arms there are. Tell us if there's a bulge at the center. If it's an elliptical, tell us what shape it is. Actually, give us the detail that we would have asked for if we'd known we were going to get this level of response. And Zoo 2 works as well. So Zoo 2 is currently up. You have, hopefully, less than a week to go and look at Zoo 2, because if we get to 60 million classifications, and we're on 59 million and some. I meant to print, we've got a counter now that I just sit watching all day. I meant to see what the latest number was. But if we get 60 million in the next week, then we have a surprise for everybody. And I'm counting on you lot. And we can actually look by city. So if there isn't a spike from Waterloo later tonight and tomorrow, I'm going to be upset. Anyway, 60 million and something spectacular happens. So Zoo 2 works very well, which is good. But what I want to do is spend 20 minutes, the 20 minutes or so I've got left, talking about the future and talking about some of the results. Because at this point, some of you are thinking I'm crazy. Because typical spiral, typical elliptical, yes, they've got different shapes, but they've also got different colours. And I know some of you will have been thinking, why can't you just sort the blue ones from the red ones? And in fact, you can do that. Because what the colour tells you about is the star formation history. The recent star formation. Because whenever you see blue stars, with due respect to Brian May from Queen, blue stars are the rock stars of the universe. They live fast and they die young. They burn through their fuel very quickly. They last for only maybe 100 million years or so. A blink of an eye in astronomical terms. And so where you see blue stars, you know there's been recent star formation. And most recent star formation in the universe is in the form of spirals. So what most people before Galaxy Zoo did, faced with the million galaxies, was just to say blue will assume their spiral. Doesn't work. We have a whole host of blue ellipticals. These are some of the most local. These are elliptical. They're close enough that we know we'd see the spiral arms if they were there. But they have a star formation rate that's up to 50 times that of the Milky Way. Our Milky Way turns about one sun's worth of stars. One sun's worth of gas into stars every year. Some of these are doing 50 times that. And this is fascinating because one of the big problems, one of the places where the model, the computer model I showed you, doesn't match reality, is in the formation of ellipticals. That computer model forms galaxies by smashing together small things. You start off with tiny blobs, they merge, you get bigger blobs and bigger blobs and bigger blobs. And just from this simple model, you can predict that the biggest galaxies in the universe should be forming today, because you need time to build up from small bricks. The biggest piles take longest to put together. Those are the ellipticals. And yet those are the galaxies that have the oldest stars. And there's evidence that the stars formed in situ. So trying to work out what happened in elliptical formation is one of the places we think we can get at some of the underlying physics. And so finding the few stragglers, these are essentially the few percent of elliptical galaxies that for some reason waited until today to form. And so trying to understand them is a laboratory, gives us a laboratory to attack what's happening in the early universe. Because no matter how big your telescope, if you look back to the time when most ellipticals are forming, they're just dots. You can get information, but they're just dots. These we can study in detail. In fact, I've had the onerous task for the last few years of going most winters to a ski resort in Spain. There's a telescope up there, I promise, called IRAM. It's a 30-meter-millimeter dish. 30 meters the dish, the millimeters the wavelengths it looks at. It's a fantastic place. You go up on the ski lift up in the Sierra Nevada. Everyone else in designer ski wear and skis, me with a laptop bag. What everyone else thinks, I don't know. And we could measure the amount of molecular gas, the fuel for star formation in each of these galaxies. And I know this is a technical plot, but it's my bit of all of this, so you have to listen to it for a few minutes. This is the time since stars began forming in the ellipticals. This is the amount of fuel that's left. This is billions of solar masses, millions. And you can see, if you're sufficiently attuned to astronomical data, that there's a drop. That at 200 million years, suddenly all the galaxies have very little fuel left for star formation. So something happens to elliptical galaxies 200 million years after they start forming their stars. And 200 million years is the time when the black hole that lurks in the center of most big galaxies starts to become restless and active. And so we have here a link between the star formation history and black hole activity. So we know there are black holes in the center of most galaxies. This is looking at the Milky Way. This is going to be 10 years worth of data. We actually watch stars orbiting the center of our Milky Way. And because we know the mass of these stars, you can work out the mass of the thing at the center, just as you can work out the mass of the sun by watching the planets orbit it. And there's no doubt that what's in here is a 3 billion solar mass black hole. That number keeps changing because it depends very much on what this star does for various technical reasons, but 3 billion-ish, give or take a billion or so. I told you astronomers don't care about numbers. And you might think that a black hole, famously, nothing can escape a black hole. So what possible influence can it have beyond gravity? Well, actually, black holes are surprisingly active players in astronomy. This is a nearby black hole, which rejoices in the name of SS-433. This is a radio image. The black hole's down in here, but you can see this sort of cosmic corkscrew coming out of the central region in both directions. What's happening is that if you overfeed a black hole, some of the material gets sent out in jets, shooting outwards from the central region, from the area just before the material drops into the black hole itself. In this case, that jet's rotating like this, and so you get this cosmic corkscrew effect, something that actually in collaboration with school children around the world, another group in Oxford are studying. But this is a local version. We call this a microquasar, but you see these things on galaxy scales as well. This is the galaxy M87, big nearby galaxy in the Virgo cluster. You can see there's this beautiful jet coming out from the center. And so we think this is what's going on in those ellipticals. We think that you have star formation triggered by some influx of material. Some of that material spirals down towards the black hole, jet is triggered, and that either heats or removes the gas from the rest of the galaxy, turning off the star formation. And if something like that happened in the early universe, that explains why the ellipticals haven't formed stars recently, because suddenly they lost all of their gas very early on. We need to know the details of this process. And actually, clues come from surprising places. one of the joys of Galaxy Zoo has been the unexpected. We had many more people than we thought click the buttons, but we knew what science we were going to get. However, people have a remarkable talent. If you tell a computer to classify this galaxy, you can't quite see because of the projection, but there are spiral arms here, so it will tell you it's a spiral and move on. And if you've optimized your routine so that all it does is do the best possible job of classifying galaxies, that's all it will tell you. However, all of you are currently wondering what Kermit the Frog is doing in this image. This was first noticed by a Dutch school teacher called Hanny van Arkel. She called this object Hanny's voorwerp, and when she emailed us about it, we thought this was a technical term, so we started using it too. Does anyone in the audience speak Dutch? No? No one's admitted? Good. In which case, my pronunciation was absolutely spot on. But voorwerp means something like thingy, object. And I'm very proud to say that we've got this title into the scientific literature. And our next goal is to get the plural in. So Hanny's voorwerpen. Fortunately, there's only one of these. It's a unique object. And it's a bit of a detective story. When you discover something unusual, something intriguing as an astronomer, a sort of unofficial system comes into play. You start calling friends who happen to be on large telescopes. And they happen to point those telescopes at this object. So in this case, we had friends who were looking at a telescope in La Palma on the Canary Islands, and they were supposed to be looking at the effects of black holes on spiral galaxies. So they had a setup that was just about perfect for looking at this thing. And they accidentally chose this object as their calibration target for the evening. It was such a coincidence. And then we could call some other friends, and you begin to build up data. And the picture is that this turned out to be a blob of glowing gas at about 50,000 Kelvin. Really warm, but with no stars in it. So the question is, how did this gas get to be 50,000 Kelvin? How did it get to be so warm if it doesn't have any stars to heat it up? You know, it's not a very difficult detective story because the culprit is standing right next to it. The obvious solution is that the black hole in the center of this galaxy is active, that there are jets that we can't see in this optical image. You could sort of imagine the geometry, and this cloud is being illuminated by a jet. Interesting, but not groundbreaking. Interesting enough that we wanted to check, so we looked for the definitive signs of black hole activity. We pointed a satellite called XMM Newton at this galaxy and looked for X-rays that are associated with black hole activity, and we found none. Well, we found 3 photons in 5,000 seconds, but essentially we found none. In other words, this black hole isn't active, and yet something heated this up. And to cut a very long story short, what we think has happened is that we've caught this galaxy in the act of switching from being active to being quiet. Sometime in the last 20,000 years, and remember 100 million years is the blink of an eye to an astronomer, 20,000 years, this was a hugely active system, but the black hole has run out of material, it's become obscured, something has happened and it's switched off. And we've always known that this happens because we see if you count the number of active systems over the course of the universe's history, you see them change. So we know this happens, but we've never caught one in the act before. And so that's what Hanny's voorwerp is. And in fact, this week and next week, the Hubble Space Telescope has been pointing at Hanny's voorwerp. So something that started with a Dutch school teacher sitting at her computer has led to the most iconic telescope in the world pointing itself at this object. I want to show you the images. I'm not allowed to, but oops. I don't know how that got there. We don't have the exciting ones yet. What we've got so far are the images of the gap in what we call a continuum. So sort of take all the light from the galaxy. The voorwerp's down here, very faint. You can see there's an extra galaxy that wasn't really obvious. It's sort of a blob here. Well, it's beautifully resolved. The point is there's a huge disrupted nucleus here. There's an awful lot going on. And so we're going to have to disentangle this. This week, we're targeting the wavelengths at which this gas is shining. And so we should get a beautiful, crystal clear image of the voorwerp. Let's skip through the next things. Because I want to tell you about this. So we have this, we're beginning to untangle the story of each of these galaxies. there are some fun results as well. Sometimes you get the unexpected. One of the things we remember that we asked people which way the spiral arms were turning. The idea is that this tells you which way the galaxy is rotating. So this galaxy is rotating clockwise, and this galaxy is rotating anti-clockwise. And so just by looking even at faint spiral arms, we can tell which way the galaxy is rotating. There was this paper by Michael Longo from the University of Michigan. He said, I've looked at a few thousand of these galaxies, and I see more of these than there are of these. And this doesn't make any sense. It absolutely doesn't make any sense. To explain this result, you have to invoke something like a universal magnetic field that we otherwise missed, because these galaxies could be on opposite sides of the sky. How do they know that more of them should all turn in the same direction? It's this cosmic conspiracy. So we thought, well, he just hasn't looked at enough galaxies. It's like tossing a coin 2,000 times. If I get 1,100 heads, can I really conclude that it's a biased coin, that it's a dodgy coin? Or is it just that I got lucky and if I did it again, I'd get 1,100 tails? So more galaxies. Well, we've got more galaxies. We've got more galaxies than anyone. So this result would be sure to go away. We found more anti-clockwise galaxies than clockwise galaxies. And for the physicists or scientists in the audience, it was a 7 sigma result. It's hugely significant. The odds of getting this by chance were vanishingly small, which is worrying. So we had great fun giving talks for a while and challenging people in the audience to come up with explanations for this. But we wanted to check the result. And so we showed people mirror images of the galaxies. And if you think about it, if this is real, we should now have more clockwise galaxies. And yet we still had more anti-clockwise galaxies. And so it's not the universe that's odd, it's our brains, which is a wonderful sentence to say, apart from anything else. And actually, it turns out there's a well-known illusion with moving pictures called the ballerina illusion. So how many of you, can we have the house lights up easily? Just a little, just so I can see them. How many of you see the ballerina rotating clockwise? Put your hands up. This is peer pressure in action. How many of you can see her rotating anti-clockwise? How many of you have seen her switch? For those who haven't, if you sort of wave your heads about like that, then you'll see her switch. Actually, that's not true. That's just amusement for me. Thank you. We can have the house lights back down now. But the point is that if you integrate over, if you take the results from a huge number of people and a huge amount of time, then you see more people see her going anti-clockwise than clockwise. It's to do with left brain, right brain. And we've discovered the same thing with galaxies. And so we're actually writing a psychology paper about this result. We've discovered something about how humans perceive faint, fuzzy shapes. It's a nice result. I can say whatever I like for the next 2 minutes, because you're all talking about the ballerina. I know this. Apparently, by the way, it doesn't work if you know ballet, because it's obvious which way she's going. And there are people, if you really know ballet, then your brain will override your instincts and have her rotating in the correct direction. I'm going to skip these for a second. So we have other projects. But what I want to spend the last 5 minutes talking about is the future of all of this. Because we've talked a bit about, you know, so far we've had a fixed target. We had 1 million galaxies. You know, I know I need 60 million classifications in Zoo 2 to be done. All I need to do is get enough people. But I think where we're going with this is that we're going to start having moving targets. And we've made a step into this by looking for exploding stars, objects called supernovae. And there are many ways to form supernovae, but one way is to find a massive star at the end of its life. When it runs out of fuel, it will explode in a dramatic explosion that's bright enough to be seen from right across the universe. A single supernova can outglow, can shine brighter than the whole galaxy that it's embedded in. So the typical way to find these things is you have a nice telescope. We use this one. Actually, this is the telescope that did the sky surveys in the 50s, 60s, and 80s. It's called the Samuel Oshin Telescope. It's down in California on Palomar Mountain. And so it now works semi-robotically. It will scan the sky. It'll look at, in fact, it has a set of galaxies it looks at every 5 nights. And it will compare the two. It'll compare its old image of the galaxy with the new one. And if it thinks it's found a difference, it will add that to a list of candidate supernovae. And then you use a big telescope like Hubble, or more typically the CAC on Hawaii, the William Herschel telescope on La Palma, to follow up on that discovery. And some proportion of what you find will be actual supernovae. The problem is that that proportion's not always hugely high. It might be 30 or 40%. And getting Hubble time is hugely precious. Astronomers all over the world spend their entire life fighting for time on these big telescopes. Not literally, you understand, but via the medium of proposals. And so we thought we'd have a go at improving this. Because again, it's pattern recognition. It's a task that humans are good at and computers are less good at. So we have supernovae, a Galaxy Zoo supernovae. So this is a zoomed in version. This is the reference image. This is a new image. And you can see that the computer thinks there's a difference here. This is this minus this. But actually, we can see there's no supernova there. This is just an artifact. There's something bright off the corner of this field. Could be a bright supernova, but that would be unlucky. It's just something's gone wrong with the observation. So we can get rid of that one, click no, and move on. We can do this very quickly. In fact, we have a cascade system. So if the first, so we have the data comes up instantaneously from California onto the web. First person looks at it. If they say it's a supernova, we very quickly show it to another three people. If the majority of them say it's a supernova, we quickly show it to another six. And we've actually got it implemented so that if you get to the bottom level and we still think it's a supernova, then it will email the astronomers who are standing by with the big telescopes. And so our aim is to complete this whole process in less than an hour, consistently. And we find that we greatly improve the success rate. So if you rely on the computer, you get 30 or 40%. If you go via the zoo, you get 80 or 90%. So I've just doubled the amount of Hubble time that I'm making good use of. And this is fantastic. And it's sort of a division of roles, because you ask the computer now, instead of asking the computer to make its best guess, you ask the computer to, you say to the computer, give me everything that might be a supernova, which might be a few thousand candidates. But because we've got lots of people, we can then get rid of the weird and the wonderful. The old option is to get the computer to make its best guess. Not only does it not do a perfect job, but it throws out a lot of stuff that really are supernovae because they don't quite fit its model. So this works very well. In fact, we want to go further. So you can still have the computer route, because it turns out that the training the computer to behave like the zoo users works very well. So you have this nice feedback loop where you actually improve the computer by getting it to think more like people. And we have this beautiful symbiosis of computers doing the bits of the pattern recognition that they can do and humans doing what we're good at. And we work together with machines in harmony as we go forward into the future. As you can see, this is a traditional image of humans working in harmony with machines. And in fact, this isn't quite, this looks a lot like Pasadena, which isn't a million miles away from Palomar. But this isn't quite the nightmare. This isn't the beautiful image that I talked about. But this nightmare is something that's beginning to haunt us. It's not a large, scary robot that's worrying us. It's this thing. This is called the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope. For scale, there's a suitably androgynous human down here. This is what the astronomers of 10 years' time will look like. No facial features at all. It's an 8.4-meter mirror, which I've stood on. It's fine, don't worry. But it's as big as the biggest telescopes today. But it will behave not like the big telescopes like Keck and Hubble, but like Sloan. It's going to scan the whole sky. In fact, it's going to scan the whole sky every 3 nights. It's going to produce, for those who are computer-minded, 70 terabytes of data a night. Which you can use for all sorts of things. You're going to see every asteroid in the solar system whipping around. You're going to watch variable stars flicker. You'll see the dimming of other stars as planets happen to go in front of them. You'll even be able to see in nearby galaxies the center flicker as the material falls into the black hole. We suddenly get a video of the universe instead of just images. But let's restrict ourselves to supernovae. Let's put LSST into this sample. And we don't quite know how it's going to perform yet. It's still 5 years away from being fully built. But a good estimate of how many candidate supernovae it will produce on one night is something like 50,000. So you're going to overwhelm even if all of you went and did Galaxy Zoo Supernovae every night, we're going to get overwhelmed. So that's why you need the computers. And so the idea is that you'd pass it to a computer. The computer, ideally, and this is what we need to work on, will say either this is a supernova, this isn't a supernova, or, I don't know, pass this to the humans. So we need an intelligent computer that knows what you can do and knows what it can do. Even if you get all of that right, we might get several thousand actual supernovae per night. And they're not going to give me Hubble to use just to look at supernovae for the next 20 years. What we're going to have to do is do some filtering. And it's my contention that actually, when I say we're going to have to do it, I mean you. I mean the interested public. I mean the people who use Galaxy Zoo. Because I think the vision looks something like this. This is a robotic telescope that's on La Palma. I think that from some combination of computers and Galaxy Zoo, you'll take the data from LSST, you'll produce a list of supernovae. Without professional astronomers getting involved, you will do follow-up. Somebody sitting at their computer in Waterloo, in Oxford, wherever, will open up this telescope in La Palma, will do instant, probably within a couple of minutes of the original detection, we will have gone through this process, will point the telescope at the supernova, decide if it's interesting, and only then do you give it to the professionals and allow us to use the biggest telescopes. We need all of this to happen automatically from our point of view. And to me, that means we need more people. We're never going to have enough astronomers. And we need this vision of the future in which it's a proper partnership between those of us who get paid to do this and those of us who do this for the love of it. Actually, when I put it like that, it doesn't sound very good, does it? That was supposed to be the big inspiring moment. The point is that the universe is a big place, and we're going to need your help to explore it. One of the things that you might select, having done the follow-up, is you might focus in on one type of supernova. You might focus on type 1A supernovae. It doesn't matter what they are, but these things always go bang with the same luminosity. They always give off the same power. That means that wherever in the universe you see them, you know how bright they were when you were standing next to them, you know how bright they appear, and that means you can work out a distance. Just as I can guess how far away these lights are by seeing how bright they appear. I'd know the difference between that being a mile away and a meter away. If you find these type 1A supernovae in the distant universe, if you find enough of them, you can measure the expansion of the universe. And so my contention is that if you really want to understand why the universe is accelerating, if you really want to attack the 70% of the universe's budget that we don't understand, then we're going to need your help. And on that note, I'll say thank you and stop. Thank you very much.
Let's open the floor to questions. If you do have a question, just raise your hand and we will deliver a microphone to you. Just a quick note, do try to be quick and concise because I already see lots of hands. We want to get to as many as we can.
Which came first, the chicken or the egg? Did galaxies form around existing black holes, or did the black holes form after the galaxies had been created?
With the caveat that we're not sure, my bet is that it was the black hole. And the reason is that the best way to create a black hole in the local universe is to have a big supernova. And you produce a black hole that might be 10, 20 times the mass of the sun. And it turns out we know, because of these jets and so on, there's a maximum rate at which you can feed these black holes. And yet we see active galaxies with big black holes very early in the universe's history, within the first billion years. Of the universe's existence. And there just hasn't been time, even if you have very early star formation, there hasn't been time to build up these big black holes. So what we think happens is that in that smooth universe, there are a few places where the density happens to be big enough that black holes can form directly. This is Martin Rees, the Astronomer Royal in the UK. This is one of the things that gained him his reputation, was working this out. But you can form these black holes directly, and that's the nucleus for the really big galaxies. Whether that's true of all galaxies, not sure. But at least in the big ellipticals, that's the picture.
As far as classification of left-handed spiral versus right-handed spiral, doesn't it depend on the perspective of the viewer?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why the result didn't make any sense. Because there's a fundamental principle, an assumption in cosmology that's called the cosmological principle. Principle sort of dignifies it too much because it's guesswork, right? But we assume that on the large scales, it doesn't matter where we are in the universe. Whatever large scale measure I'm at, if I ask about density of the universe as a whole, if I ask about the structure, if I ask about pretty much anything, it doesn't matter where we are. But this, if you really did have more anticlockwise galaxies, then I could change that large-scale observation just by going to the other side of them and looking back. So that's exactly why this is a problem. Turns out, though, that on small scales, we get something else interesting. Once you account for this bias, we find that if you have two galaxies next to each other, they're most likely to be spinning in the same direction. And that tells us something about where they get their spin from. Because the old model was that you have two galaxies which aren't spinning, and they go past each other, and this one could spin in that direction, and this one could spin in the opposite direction, and then they could carry on. We actually see the opposite. They're spinning in the same direction, and so they must pick up their spin from the wider universe, from those filaments or from the structure around them. So on small scales, we could say something sensible. On large scales, it really shouldn't matter, and that's why we expect 50-50.
Where does the black hole lead to?
Are there any theorists in the audience? It doesn't have to leak anywhere. It's a region of space that's cut off from our universe that you could put, at least from an observer's point of view, you could put as much as you like into a black hole. It's cut off, but it's still there. It doesn't disappear. Nothing magic happens to it. It's just that light can't reach us from the material that falls into the black hole. So you can play around, and the theories will let you, especially if you're much cleverer than I am, will let you connect the black hole to other bits of space to give you wormholes and white holes and all sorts of good, fun stuff. But from a theorist point, from an observer's point of view, it's just a sink. It's a bottomless sink. And you could, rather like my desk, paper goes on and stays there, and there seems to be no limit as to how much I can put on it. Black hole is very much like that. They do evaporate, I guess. That's one thing. Stephen Hawking gave us this idea. So if you leave a black hole long enough, and you don't have anything else to do, and you sit and watch it, you'll see that it will very slowly give off tiny amounts of light, for reasons that I don't have time to go into. But this is called Hawking radiation. And on something like 10 to the 120 year timescales, 10 to the 100 year timescales, so one followed by lots of zeros, then the black holes in the universe will evaporate slowly and give out their mass is in the form of light.
Hello, I'm wondering in the globular clusters, you said there's a point where star formation seems to drop off. And I was just wondering, is there a point where there is a deficit of material where everything would seem to be, for lack of a better word, kind of sopped up and all the stars would be created? And then the spaces in between would somehow be devoid of extraneous gas.
So do you mean in the spiral galaxies, on the edges of the galaxies?
No, more so in the, where you said, I think it was where the globular clusters were forming, or the globular galaxies.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah.
So no, we think it, well, you can imagine, like this thing over here. So it's more that the raw material has disappeared. So certainly within the core of the galaxy, there isn't, we don't see, if I go up to my ski resort in the Sierra Nevada and look, we don't see any of the fuel for star formation. So you're right that it could be living outside those galaxies. You know, that they may be drawing on a reservoir from outside, and that somehow that reservoir has been removed from the ellipticals. So that's one possibility. You can imagine that it just gets used up. You know, natural wastage, we know what rate they're forming stars at, so you can work out how long it would take to use up the available reservoir. That doesn't seem to fit the details of the stars that we see. And so we end up with the hypothesis that actually something dramatic happens to expel the gas from the center of the galaxy. And whether it expels it completely or whether it ends up in this sort of reservoir but never falls back down is something we'd like to find out.
Let's take two more questions, one there and one there.
I just started galaxy zooing last night.
Thank you.
You caused me a great deal of anxiety. performance anxiety.
And so we're all in it together. You really shouldn't be worried. Your mistakes are corrected.
Exactly. That's the point. And thank you for pointing that out. But there was a lot of squinting and a lot of flipping back and forth between the positive and negative images, and it all looked the same. But are there other factors that you guys can accommodate in terms of human error or other, you know, like the favoring of the counterclockwise?
Well, yeah, so we do. And one of the joys of having so many people is that we all make different errors. And so sometimes those are errors like the counterclockwise that are in our heads. Sometimes they're just because of the data. So for example, as you look at fainter, smaller, or more distant galaxies, the percentage of ellipticals we see goes up, right? And that's not your fault or mine, mostly. It's that we just can't see the spiral arms, but we can measure that because of the number of people we have. So yeah, we do that. One of the things we try is we let everyone play, and then we have tried giving weightings to people afterwards. So we have Kevin's 50,000. So we can, if you always agree with Kevin, we might decide to pay more attention to you. And if I always disagree, then my weight goes down. What's intriguing is that actually for the main task, that doesn't make much difference. And the other thing we see for Zoo 2 is that different people are good at different questions. So the people who you should listen to if you want to know how many spiral arms there aren't the people you should listen to if you want to know what shape the galaxy is. It's really fascinating. And so we find that, you know, it sounds like I'm flanneling now, but really, everyone has a unique talent. Actually, the strongest indicator of how good the data is just how many different people have contributed to that task. And so, really, all of you, if you only have 3 weeks to spend on the site, then that's useful. No, but in all seriousness, just 10 to 50 galaxies from each of you will greatly improve the data. So thank you. You're off the hook, but I'm still looking at your neighbors. Good.
The project is bridging or closing the communication gap between scientist and amateur. And I was just wondering if you think that this is going to impact how in the future of how we do science, how we conduct research, and even how we define science.
That's a brilliant question to have last. I'm glad you've all got another hour. So let me start small and get more hand wavy until I get cut off. So yeah, I think we're not the only ones doing this, but this kind of project is really important to me because I've always done both science and what we call outreach, which is coming and talking to you about the wonderful things that I do. And it's a it makes a huge amount of difference to be able to come here and talk to you about what a group of people like yourselves have done. And if it does one thing, I hope it illustrates that science isn't something only for those in beautiful places like the Perimeter Institute, or sitting in ivory towers in Oxford, but is actually an activity that anyone could get involved in. And I think we did a survey of 10,000 users. Volunteers. I've been trying to kick that for 3 years. And we said, why do you do this? And I expected the answer, well, galaxies are pretty, or, you know, I'm an amateur astronomer. And the answer we got overwhelmingly by about half of the people said that they did it because they wanted to contribute to research. And we actually have a whole group, which we call the Citizen Science Alliance, but it's a group of museums and universities who are committed to seeking out other places in science where there's too much data and where the public can help. So we have projects you've seen the planetary science ones, astronomy will keep going. We have projects in ecology involving crow behavior. We have projects in oceanography. We have a project in climate science. We even have a project looking at 6 million fragments of ancient papyri that have been dug out of the sand of ancient Egypt and are waiting to be transcribed. So I think this is, when I said at the beginning that this problem of having too much stuff is shared by all scientists, I honestly think that to make the most of it, we need tens and hundreds of thousands of people to get involved. So if you haven't got that message yet, thank you for giving me another chance to say it. Thank you.
Thank you.